Hello everyone, welcome back to another episode of the CSW Free to Believe Spotlight Series on North Korea podcast. I'm Sam Jackson Reed, your host. I'm joined today by David Simpson, our advocate for North Korea. How are you doing, David?
Thanks for having me, Sam. I'm doing very, very well. Thank you.
Good to hear. On the top of the episode, just need to mention a few things. Apologies to everyone. We've been away for a bit. A few scheduling things meant that these episodes have taken a little bit of a while to come out. But this is the North Korea wrap-up episode. We're going to be wrapping up on this fascinating series that we've been doing. And then we're going to be taking a break for most of December and a little bit of January before we come back with another series. So thank you for listening already. It's been really wonderful to be putting these out in the world, to be having these conversations, and we hope that they've been educating you, that you found them interesting and helpful. In the meantime, during that period of time, there's obviously plenty of things on our website that you can go and read if you're looking to find out more about North Korea, about Sudan, about any of the countries that we work on. We're also running a matched giving appeal right now. So if you have been enjoying the podcast and you feel like you could give some money to help support the work that we do, we currently have a matched giving appeal that you can go and give to, where every pound that you give, up to £48,200, will be matched by some very generous CSW supporters. So please go and do that. The links are in the episode description. That's enough housekeeping. We're going to jump straight in to the episode. So David, what we thought we were going to do today is sort of take ourselves back theme by theme to the beginning of the podcast, the beginning of the series, and kind of do a little bit of a wrap up on how those themes are affecting North Koreans on the ground. Because that's really what we've been trying to articulate in this series is, you know, there's all of these top headline issues which are important for us to discuss, but really there are real people on the ground being affected by this, and we need to remember them. And we cannot look away from what is going on to real people on the ground. So yeah, we're gonna walk through some of those themes that we've discussed kind of at that top level that we heard from Timothy Cho and we heard from Lee Jun, and all of the rest of the episodes. So I thought we could kick off with the first theme, the kind of North Korean diaspora, the North Koreans who have escaped North Korea, refugees, you know, those issues that Timothy Cho and that Lee Jun were kind of drawing us through. What are some of the things that maybe we didn't cover in those episodes? Maybe what are some things that you feel are really important for us to know? You know, that if people were... What's the one thing, you know, if people are going to take away from having listened to this series and somebody said, oh, what were you listening to? Oh, I was listening to this and it was about North Korean refugees. What's kind of like the top level things that you'd want them to know about how that's affecting real people on the ground in North Korea?
Yeah, thanks, Sam. I think that particularly in today's climate, conversation around refugees is very polarizing. And it's sort of a hot button topic. And I think if anyone wants to ruin their, if anyone wants to ruin their family Christmas dinner, they could bring up the topic of refugees. And I'm sure they would be a feisty and robust conversation with all your different friends and relatives there. So I think when we think about refugees, often the conversation revolves on the country that receives them, which is sort of at the very end of the journey, that there's a final country. This is often called a safe country or a third country. In UN parlance. But really, if we only think about reception of refugees, we sort of miss the point entirely, that refugees have had an incredible, harrowing, unbelievable journey to get to the places that they end up. And that is especially true for North Koreans. And if there's any refugee community we should be hospitable towards, it's North Koreans. And that, A, is because they have left one of the most horrific, barbaric regimes on earth. And B, and this is a practical one, the numbers of North Koreans in the world outside of North Korea are small. In South Korea, there may only be around 30,000 North Koreans from a population of sort of 40 million or so. So a very, very small percentage of the population. And in other parts of the world, there's maybe another 5,000. And so a really small amount of a really small number in a much wider context of people on the move around the world. And since 2020 and since COVID, the North Korean border with China, which is where pretty much all the refugees flee, has been closed. And it's been militarized, and it's one of the most monitored places in the world. The Chinese government has helped the North Korean government and make it one of the most sophisticated places of cameras, of drones, of surveillance, so heat sensors. So they've made it essentially an impregnable barrier for people to cross. And so the folks that have left recently were already outside of the country. And that's happened in a couple of different ways. And we know that in Russia, for example, because of the Russia and Ukraine war, lots of men, the conscription age, I believe, is between 18 and 60. So lots of men who would do jobs like logging, like fishing, working in factories, they've been sent to the front lines to fight. And the Russian government has hired North Koreans to do those labor jobs. And this has happened in China as well, particularly in logging, that there are North Koreans who the Chinese government pays the North Korean government, and the laborers and the workers themselves don't see a single penny of that money. And so the folks that do leave often have been outside of North Korea for a long time, and they flee from places like logging camps in Russia and in China, and then they start their perilous journey through China, through Mongolia, through Vietnam, often by foot, often walking through forests, under roads, under highways, because they know at any turn they could be returned to North Korea. And if they're returned to North Korea, they themselves would face horrific torture, punishment, execution, but their families would too. And so I think we have to work through our reaction to the word refugee and think about the story of where do these people come from and what is their story of how they ended up and where they are. And ultimately, we as Christians in this time of Advent, we're recording this at the start of Advent, we remember that Jesus himself was a refugee, that his very first weeks and months on earth were spent on the run towards Egypt, modern day Egypt. And so I think it's particularly pertinent and important and relevant in these early days of Easter. And we think about Christ's journey as a refugee with his young, scared parents. And we think about other young, scared parents with children who are fleeing other parts of persecution, danger, war, and specifically religious persecution around the world today.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear that, because I think we have this perception, don't we, of, well, I mean, if listening to Timothy and listening to Lee, we had these kind of two generations, right? We had this the generation from the 90s and the arduous march and the famine, and then we had the kind of more Gen Z, elder, like late millennial kind of move, and actually shifting and moving for quite different reasons, right? Like responding to North Korea, to the situation in North Korea slightly differently. And then now we've got this situation where, like you said, actually people who are escaping North Korea are already outside, which is fascinating. I don't think people would know much about that, wouldn't necessarily know that they're in Russia, on the front lines in Ukraine and all of that kind of stuff. I guess, yeah, what are some of those reasons why people are, and it's the same with refugee stories, you know, across the world. The reason why somebody might leave is going to end up being quite personal, though it may be tied into the more kind of headline picture. There's going to be some personal connection there, isn't there? There's going to be some sort of responding to that situation as an individual or as a family that means that they move, and we need to listen to those stories, don't we?
No, we do. And I think there's, as you say, there's no one reason why people leave. And I think it's rare for one event to force somebody to leave. I think it's often a case of the straw that broke the camel's back, that there's sort of a buildup of things that make it increasingly inhospitable, dangerous, and impossible for people to stay in the places that they are. And I think you might find it. So, for example, I know and met recently a former North Korean official who worked at an embassy overseas, a prominent embassy that was a communist country and an ally of North Korea. You may remember that in 2019, President Trump, in his first term in office, held a summit with Kim Jong-un in Singapore and then in Hanoi. There was lots of anticipation that this would bring relief for the Kim regime and there would be some territory given, some leeway given. But it was an object failure. And none of that was given. And Kim was seen to be sent back to North Korea with his sort of tail between his legs. And none of the hopes of relief from sanctions or sanctions against nuclear regime were given to him. And because of that, the two senior officials who were at the meeting, one was executed and one was sent into prison and forced labor. And this official in the other country went through sort of diplomacy school with one of them. And he saw that as the final straw that these guys are diplomats. They're trying to do their job. Often in political dialogue, things don't quite go as planned, but you pick yourself up, you go again. He was somebody that grew up in North Korea, obviously. He was in the system. He was a cog in the political machine, and he was placed at a key ally overseas. And so for him, he calculated the cost of my family still in North Korea. My friends are still in North Korea. I don't know what I'm going to do, but enough is enough. I can't do this anymore. And so he drove in the dead of night. He literally jumped over the fence of the embassy and drove to another embassy and declared and claimed asylum. And so I think it's different for everyone. Obviously, that's a more kind of dramatic case, but it might be simpler. It might be that you have a relative that leaves and they get word to you or you hear through radio that they're safe and you want to go join them. Folks watch South Korean TV dramas. I think we mentioned on another podcast recording that we know a North Korean escapee who the thing that burst his bubble was South Koreans in a K-drama talking about dieting. That he lived in such a food-scarce society, he could not imagine a world where people actively chose to eat less, to lose weight, and to look better. And for us, like, dieting is a very normal thing, and maybe not around this time of year. but for him, it, like, the idea and concept of dieting was something that was so foreign to the world he lived in. It was the thing that gave him outside perspective. You know, the old adage, if you want to know what water's like, don't ask a fish, because the fish has never left. It doesn't know anything different. You need that outside perspective. And I think it's a crucial thing in the North Korean human rights context is to get information from the outside world into North Korea. And I think often those are the things that sort of are the little chips in the armor that eventually lead to somebody being willing to take the risk and the chances to leave.
And it's still phenomenally dangerous. You know, it's like it with the that chink in the armor, the moment the epiphany happens and it's kind of, oh, I need to get out of here. It's not a simple decision to make, right? And we're looking at a world where, you know, just picking up from what we've talked about in these episodes, that actually that journey has got harder, not easier, over time. What is being done, I suppose, at that kind of advocacy level, within the kind of institutions that the UN, the EU, kind of on a political level, geopolitical level, what is being done or not being done and needs to be done to kind of aid those who are trying to escape? And then probably in a little moment, we'll get to that kind of more of that. What are we doing to try and increase the level of information into the country? But in terms of for those who are trying to escape, you know, it's a really dangerous journey where they could be sent back to North Korea and tortured and or put to death. What is happening around the world? What are the nations doing? What are charities like CSW, like we are doing to kind of have an impact on that?
No, it's a good question and a relevant question. But I would kind of go back to the start of your question and say, even if you are successful in escaping, you know for a fact that your friends and family will face hardship in North Korea. And so even if you do make it to a safe place, you know for sure your family, your close family and your close friends will be interrogated. They'll be jailed. They may even be tortured. They may even be executed. So the price of being successful in escaping is an unimaginable burden to bear even in and of itself. And so I don't know if that is what level of success that is, you know, that it's such a burden for escapees that they know because they've made it out, others are paying the price for that. And so I think that's we always have to remember that like they are wherever they are, if they're in the US, they're in Canada, they're in the UK, but they know for sure that folks back home are paying the price for their escape.
And just coming back to that, what you were mentioning earlier about refugeedom at large is actually, we have no idea what people are leaving behind them, you know, and the pain that they may come with, you know, particularly in that kind of global discussion on refugees, there's this kind of caricature almost, or this kind of broad brushstrokes way of having that discussion. But one of the things that we don't often think about is what was left behind, what sorrow is actually going to be there. I mean, when we talked with Timothy, and he talked about, you know, I'd love to take you to my country. I'd love for you to see my country. I'd love for you to see what's beautiful about my country, the landscape, his friends who he left behind. You know, there's something is always left behind, and I think we can kind of sometimes create quite a simplistic view where it's like, well, you're coming to the UK or the US and we have it so great and everything. Of course you want to be here and now everything's going to be great. Well, actually, no, it's much more complex than that, isn't it?
No, definitely. I think that's accurate. And in relation to your the second part of your question around what sort of options or systems programs are in place for North Koreans, I would say right now, not a lot. So at this time, the UN reports that there are around 4% of the world's population are asylum seekers, refugees, internally displaced people. So that's nearly 300 million people. Wow. So roughly the population of Indonesia, or slightly less than the population of the US. Wow. So it would make it the third or fourth largest country in the world. So a spectacular amount of people are displaced in the world right now. And people will say this is the most, like, more people are displaced now than any time in history. And that's true, but the world's population has also gotten bigger, and it's always hovered around 3.5 to 4%. And I think the argument should be, if we've been able to deal with that percentage in the past, we can deal with it now. And so I think that's important to remember, is it's as a pure number, it's the biggest ever. But as a percentage, it's not. And I think we have to frame it in the context of we've dealt with large amounts of refugees in the past. We can do it again. And specifically for North Koreans, they're the tiniest little trickle in that big number. And so there should be absolutely no question that we can take care of them. And I think it would be one of the few refugee situations where there's pretty much no disagreement on these people deserve safe refuge elsewhere in the world. I'll give you one example of a special system in place, then one worry. So in Southeast Asia, the UNHCR, that's the United Nations High Commission on Refugees, their main office is in Bangkok in Thailand. And so if a North Korean were to escape into China, or from China, if they're already there, they would have to make their way to Thailand, because that's the closest country that wouldn't return a refugee to North Korea, because all the other countries they would walk through are kind of communist aligned countries. So that would be China, that'd be Vietnam, that'd be Cambodia. You do hear rare stories of folks who make it into Vietnam and then just knock on the door of the South Korean embassy and are resettled that way. Wow. But that's in the minority. Most people make it to Thailand, which is a walk of several thousand miles. through jungles, through mountains, through incredibly harsh terrain. If you go in the winter, it could be minus 20. If you go in the summer, it could be 35 degrees. Just brutal terrain, and a long way. And when you get to Thailand, so if you're a refugee from another country, you would have to start a process where you would register with the UN, you would wait for an interview, and they would make a determination on the validity of your case. And then that would start the process of resettlement to a third country. And that process could take years. Mm. Typically, it takes around 7 to 9 years is common for refugees to be resettled if they are lucky enough to be resettled. But for North Koreans, if they arrive in Thailand, they can declare themselves to a Thai police officer, and then they'll hand them over to a separate system that's managed by the South Korean government in Thailand. And they can be resettled to South Korea quite quickly. And there has to be a vetting process to make sure people aren't, and to make sure what people's background is in North Korea. But they can end up back in South Korea within several months, as opposed to several years. And so that's one unique program that's available to North Koreans. If they make it to Thailand, there's a whole separate system for them. One big issue now is in Trump's recent BBL, the Big Beautiful Bill, there was no provision for the North Korean Human Rights Act, which was initially signed into law in 2004 by George W. Bush, and has had bipartisan support ever since. That bill has funded North Korean human rights work, but also crucially, it's funded the acceptance and pathways for refugees from North Korea to come to the U.S. and support for them while they're in the U.S. And currently, that bill is not operational, so there's no pathway for North Koreans to come to the U.S. And also on our own country in the U.K., we know that the former Conservative government and this current Labour government have kind of doubled down on the legal routes for people to claim asylum outside of the UK and in the UK. They've ostensibly made it impossible to do either. And so it's a really depressing state of affairs where the UK has kind of made it impossible for folks to legally claim asylum in the UK, even if they are from somewhere like North Korea. And so it's depressing that that's the state of affairs. And there are still some pathways available to Canada, to Australia. But because there's so few people applying for those routes now, like we mentioned, because of the border closure in 2020. So for context, before 2020, several hundred people would leave North Korea every year. Mm. And since 2020, it's maybe 15 or 20.
Wow.
So really, really small numbers. And then... So I think that would be kind of an answer to your question is there are special systems available to folks if they make it to Thailand, for example. I am concerned about the removal of the North Korean Human Rights Act and the impact that's having not only on the human rights advocacy, research, information gathering, sending information into North Korea, but also explicitly for the provisions it gave to bring refugees to the U.S., and to care for them while they're there, and similarly for the UK government's inhospitality towards refugees just now.
Which makes it difficult, doesn't it? To, you know, we talk a lot here at CSW in our communications around North Korea, around particularly praying for and calling for China to stop repatriating North Korean refugees. It's quite difficult then to also then, you know, we're also saying to the UK or to the US, please also be hospitable to North Korean refugees. It's kind of makes that whole conversation a lot harder, doesn't it? Because the routes are closing. It's much more difficult to kind of... things become in the abstract a little bit, I guess, don't they? Rather than in the concrete kind of, this is what that pathway could look like. It's sort of like, oh, we want people to be free from North Korea, but we're not going to actually make that easy for them.
Yeah, and I think because in practicality, so few folks are using those systems just now, sure. And they kind of become obsolete and not used.
Yeah, yeah.
But for the few folks who are in the position to use them, it becomes kind of harder because the systems aren't there.
Yeah. Well, hopefully that gives people a bit of that, a few of those things to kind of take away from that particular theme. I guess that leads us reasonably nicely into, you know, because actually one of the major places that North Korean refugees, escapees are going to be, kind of one of the easiest routes is into South Korea, right? But even then, though, that relationship of being North Korean and South Korea is not always easy. We had that episode on kind of the shared history of South Korea, North Korea. What's kind of the current context for that? I think obviously since last, that there was that the change of government, the kind of attempted coup in South Korea. Forgive me if I'm getting the language there incorrect, but there's been a shift of government. How has that changed that kind of relationship between South Korea and North Korea? What's going on there, kind of in the current context, and how is that going to be impacting North Korean people on the ground?
No, I think you're right in describing things like they were. So a complicated situation that led to an election, and the party that was in power is no longer in power.
Can you give like just a brief rundown of what happened for us?
Yeah, so the martial law was declared on December 3rd, 2024. And so the President Yul, at the time, he was trying to protect his own power. And so he declared martial law so he could pass some legislation through the Korean government. And it came out after the fact that he had authorized the use of lethal force when he declared martial law, which obviously was highly, highly unpopular. And so there was kind of there's like several layers of, he shouldn't have declared martial law. He declared martial law illegally. And in the martial law, he authorized his forces to use lethal force. And this happened in the context of there was a bribery scandal. People are interested, they can do a deep dive on it. And so there was an election, he was impeached, he was jailed, and there was an emergency election, and the new party are now in power. And they're slightly more, I hesitate to say progressive because they're not progressive, but they're more center-left, sure. And Yoon's party was more center-right. And so the big difference is the more conservative party were much more strong on traditional human rights, and they would hold the Korean, North Korean government to account on human rights issues. And they did not shy away from pointing out human rights abuses. And they mostly did this through the Ministry of Unification, the MOU, which is a branch of the Korean government that deals with North Korean human rights issues. And the new government, the center-left government, they don't have as strong of a human rights approach. And they would typically do more things to try and engage the North Korean government than they would do to try and hold its feet to the fire, as it were. So a few years ago at the Winter Olympics, there was a unified North Korean ice hockey team, for example, where there was players from both the South and the North that would play together. So there's these kind of efforts to engage versus hold their feet to the fire. And crucially, the MOU would get funding from the South Korean government to do human rights work. And the new government have removed all of that funding. And so you kind of have a perfect storm where the U.S. funding under the 2004 North Korean Human Rights Act, the funding from the MOU, both of those fundings together made up about 80% of all funding for North Korean wow. human rights. And now that's gone. And so there is a funding crisis, an existential funding crisis right now in the North Korean human rights world, which is happening in the context of an existential funding crisis for human rights work generally. So I think that it's a really tough situation. And the political climate in South Korea doesn't make it easy for human rights groups who are specifically focusing on North Korea to exist, to sustain and to have partners in the government who are willing to kind of hold North Korea's feet to the fire.
And the impact of that on North Korean people, I'm assuming, is that essentially there's less people on the outside advocating for their human rights. It's going to be harder to, like you said earlier on, those chinks in the armor, you know, it's going to be harder and harder and harder to produce those sort of chinks in the armor.
I think that's fair. And I think it means less information is going to get in. And there are a few groups that specialize in sort of radio transmission, information transition, transmission into North Korea. And those groups are struggling to survive in the current climate. And so maybe in 2026, some stage in 2026, those broadcasts may cease entirely, which would be tragic. It would be a huge step back.
And coming into that the conversation that we were having that you had with Jonathan Corrado, where it talked about actually it seems to be from the latest data that they had that actually the perspective on the Kim family, the regime in North Korea, is actually sort of shifting towards slightly more positive, because actually Kim has been much more active and seemingly investing in media and communication towards young people within the country. So again, potentially a pretty perfect storm there, if we're saying one of the most important things is getting that information in to try and kind of knock at the, you know, knock it down piece by piece. And actually at the same time, you have this huge investment in propaganda essentially and a closed border. So you just got this kind of closing in again of everything going on in North Korea.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. And so when we think about North Korea, we have to remember it's not that old. And so it goes back to the early 50s when there was a ceasefire in the Korean War. And so there's really like 3.5 generations of folks that have been born and raised in North Korea. And so the people that are the most disloyal or have the most animosity towards the Kim regime are folks in their 40s just now. So people that were born in the late 80s, early 90s. And that's in part because there was a catastrophic famine in the early 90s, where up to 2 million people died. And so folks that are older than that, or kind of were growing up in that, and on the one hand, they had this vision of the Kim regime will never let us down. The Kim regime will provide for all our needs. The Kim regime fought off the terrible advances of the West. And we've survived. We've been given jobs. And we've protected our cultural identity. But then the famine happened, and it was exposed the lie that the Kim regime wasn't able to do all those things. But the younger regime, or pardon me, the younger generation has never had that catastrophic experience of the regime letting them down. And is in a media environment where the Kim regime has controlled and harnessed their own media systems, ecosystems, to shape a narrative for the better. And so I think that is a large factor in this conversation, is the youngest generation hasn't experienced a catastrophic letdown like other generations have. And in the context of self-editing and self sort of protecting what you say, so you don't come across as defaming or slandering the regime, people don't talk about the famine. People don't talk about the ways that the regime hasn't provided. So the younger folks haven't necessarily heard firsthand accounts of what it was like for the regime to let them down, because folks self-policed to not say those things out loud.
And one of the
self-censorship.
Yeah, one of the big things that's been mentioned kind of across the episodes was this anti-reactionary and thought law. I guess that's been playing a part in that same kind of self-censorship, I'm assuming.
Yeah, so the anti-reactionary and thought law has been around for a while, but it was edited and kind of put out in 2021. And interestingly, it's like for our work, it specifically mentioned religious activities as being counter to or incompatible with the Kim regime. And for us, that's interesting because if they added it as a new and recent edit, you wouldn't necessarily make legislation to prevent something that wasn't happening. Mm. So it's at least some implied that religious activity is happening, because you wouldn't create a bill to limit it if it wasn't happening. And so there seems to be some sort of development, at least in the practice of the law, from when it was originally written to this update in 2021, that there's more of an awareness of religious practice in North Korea by the Kim regime. It also gives some severe punishment for watching things like K-dramas. And because like we've talked about, that is a huge influence of people have been told, for generations that the South is evil, the West is evil, it's corrupt, it's dangerous, and there's no good things there. And they watch a K-drama and they see bustling streets, they see healthy people, they see fat, they see people that are well fed, they see cars, they see people that are dressed well, and they think that that doesn't look that bad. And that looks quite appealing, actually. And yeah, there was the well-reported situation of two teenagers who were, one was executed and one was sent to forced labor for watching a K-drama. That the laws are draconian and extreme, and people are punished for doing things that we do every day, which is consuming media from other parts of the world.
And bringing the religious context into that, you know, Christianity or any kind of religion is going to offer a different view, you know, to the regime. It's going to offer a kind of different worldview, a different imagination, a different context. And thinking back to the film that we made in South Korea, and we interviewed our partners at the Transitional Working Justice Group, and one of them said, you know, there is no religion in North Korea. The only religion is the Kim family. And that kind of, as you said, with the editor of the law, it's almost like setting up these kind of, there's the Kim family and there's other religions, and the Kim family is the religion of North Korea, and that's the place that it's trying to take and trying to crush whatever else is kind of burgeoning up.
Yeah, and I think that there's a sense that there's limited oxygen for the North Korean political regime, and anything that takes oxygen away from the Kim regime is a threat, whether it's religious, whether it's political, whether it's whatever. That I don't necessarily think they're pushing the deity of the Kim regime explicitly, in like a religious sense. But I think it's just a totalitarian iron grip where anything that challenges him is a threat and needs to be eliminated.
Yeah, that makes sense. So moving into that kind of conversation, the Kim family, the kind of, that sort of brings us to the security issues, the issues of the kind of geopolitical position of North Korea, that conversation with Jonathan Corrado in particular. Again, drawing us from that place, what is the impact for North Koreans on the ground? I think we've talked maybe a little bit, we've mentioned throughout the series of, in a way, actually what happens is human rights become kind of diminish in the face of these massive security, nuclear proliferation, you know, issues. Maybe just talk us through a little bit of that. Like, why is that important for us to know about and to care about?
Yeah, I think it's important because North Korea does pose a legitimate threat to security in the region and further afield. And I think when it poses a threat, countries are on their toes and they're alert. And I think they want to respond or defend themselves to the threat versus to engage with humanitarian issues. I think that's that's like a natural self-preservation. And we kind of see this in some of, like, back to our early conversations, some of the refugee conversations, is that sort of the protection of a perceived threat and prevents human rights work taking place. And so I think because people are so, or countries are alert and on their toes and they perceive a threat, they don't want to engage on a humanitarian level. They want to kind of build up defenses. And I think in some regard that has merit to it. The Kim regime is North Korea is one of the most sanctioned places on earth, and pretty much every aspect of life there is sanctioned, and it's impossible for North Korean banks, people in North Korea who are just everyday citizens with a North Korean bank, they can't receive money, they can't send money. It's really hard for them to do anything outside of North Korea. And that affects not just the regime, but everyday citizens. You know, we live in a time where you can wire someone money on any corner of the earth, and we can transfer money, we can send money. And so even for folks who, say, a North Korean that has a relative in the US, if they were to send money to their relatives back home, they have to send it to China. That person in China has to go to the border or send it to the border. That person smuggles it over, And somebody takes a cut here, somebody takes a cut there, somebody takes a cut there. And so the folks I've spoken to say, if you send $100, your relatives get $50.
Yeah.
And so because of the sanctions, sanctions affect everyday folks the most. And it's really unfortunate. And if folks want to do a bit more on kind of the economic state in North Korea, there's a really good BBC podcast called The Lazarus Heist, which talks about a group of government-sponsored, trained hackers who have stolen billions and billions of dollars and funneled it into the North Korean regime. And so the North Korean regime has money, but it's using it pretty much for its own self-preservation and for armament purposes. Mm-hmm. They're not spending it on education. They're not spending it on hospitals. They're not spending it on roads. And so the limited money that is there isn't being used for things that benefit everyday people. And it's being used for stuff that benefits the Kim regime. Kim and his family and his closest allies live a gilded life of opulence, where the everyday citizens struggle to survive and many starve. And so I think that's a stark contrast. And I think sanctions, ultimately, they affect everyday folks on the ground more than they do the elite rulers, because the elite rulers will always find a way to live a life of opulence at the expense of those they're supposed to lead and care for.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the big point that we're wanting to make, isn't it? Is that with all of these issues, at the end of the day, there are ordinary people from North Korea who are being affected the most, and their human rights are important, and we care about them, and we long to see them have full access to those human rights, full access to freedom of religion or belief, free access to all of the freedoms that they should have. I suppose, and this is a difficult question, and one that I can imagine that when if you're an advocate and you're asked this, maybe it's sometimes a bit tricky, you know, but it is that sort of what can we do? You know, somebody listening to this right now, how can we, and maybe, you know, maybe you'll give us a number of different things, but I think about this in a, you know, not everyone's going to be able to go to the UN or, you know, basically it's very unlikely anyone's going to be going and trying to get to smuggle people out of North Korea, right? Like that's not necessarily what that question is, but what are even just small things that we can do to be a part of awareness, education, and ultimately advocacy for the people of North Korea, as we listen to all of this, these things that are going on?
No, I think it's a good question. I mean, we live in kind of crazy times right now. It can seem like crazy times, at least. If you flip on the news, there'll be stories about the Russia and Ukraine war. There'll be stories about South Sudan. There'll be stories about Nigeria. There'll be stories maybe about Myanmar. Maybe the US is going to go to war with Venezuela. Like, there's no end to stories that would alarm us and that would worry us. And I think other than nuclear or other than missile and rocket tests, we rarely hear about North Korea in the news. And so I think there is limited oxygen in the media supply or the media ecosystem, and we have limited capacity to process bad things that are going on in the world. And I think that, and this is, like, we didn't even mention Gaza. Like, it's 70,000 people have died there. It's unimaginable, the carnage and destruction and death that's going on all around the world. And I think because North Korea is a protracted and complicated situation that's been going on since the 50s, it's natural that media attention and our attention is drawn to conflicts that have happened more recently and are going on right now as we speak. So I think at a very basic level, don't forget North Korea. Don't forget that it exists. Don't forget that people are still suffering there. And like you've talked about, Sam, to when you think about North Korea, don't think about Kim. Don't think about the weirdness and the madness of his family. Don't think about the missiles. Think about everyday North Korean citizens who are just trying to survive. And they're the ones who are ultimately paying the price for the despotism of the Kim regime. It's everyday people. And so I think to remember that, yeah, just remember the people of North Korea. And it may not be much right now, but I think when opportunities do arise, people are more willing and ready to act if they've kind of kept in touch with issues.
Yeah.
And so I think we are in a time where there's not a lot happening right now. There's not a lot of political will to engage because there's just so much other stuff going on. And so I would just encourage people to not forget North Korea, to pray for North Koreans, to pray that some of the very few options available to people would reopen, and that when those people do arrive there, they would receive warmth, they would receive hospitality, and they'd be able to start to engage in a meaningful way in the world. And so if you do see articles, if you do see things, you can share, keep an eye on our work, because typically if we post about a country, we'll have very specific asks. You'll see that we're asking the UK government to do X, we're asking the UN to do Y, and you could contact a local MP, you could ask them to raise a question in Parliament, and you could ask them to make a you know, there's lots of like technical things you can do. So just keep an eye out for our work when we have a specific ask. And we're normally quite good at doing that. And if you live in South London, go to New Malden, eat at one of the Korean restaurants there. You might not know this, but New Malden is actually home to a lot of North Korean refugees. So you may come across a North Korean, might be serving you, they might be cooking you dinner. So just kind of familiarize with the smells, the sights, the sounds. And if you do that, just think of the folks in North Korea, the citizens, the everyday people who are bearing the brunt of things.
Yeah, I think that's really powerful. And actually, as you mentioned, with our work at CSW, the report that we launched last year, We Cannot Look Away, is full of our recommendations to the UN, to the US, to, you know, if people want to get really practical, yeah, absolutely, going and reading those, and from that, emailing your MP, emailing your member of Congress, and being like, I care about these issues, I think we should be doing these things. Communicate in that way. That's actually a really practical, if people want to get that technical. And yeah, absolutely, using these big issues, you know, if you see something about the Kim regime on the news, use it and let it lead you to prayer for the people. You know, it's leading you down into that, into the real tangible, the real tangible things. Yeah, I think that's great, and I love that idea. I think you've mentioned on previous podcasts, maybe one with Darren a year ago or so, you know, one of the best ways to connect with some of these issues is to meet people or engage with the cultures of the people that we're talking about. That can produce such a degree of empathy, understanding, and actually draw you closer, and actually help. I find it helps me pray. It helps me pray more accurately, helps me pray and actually connect it with something that I've experienced or I understand. I think that's a really powerful way to go about it. Well, David, thank you very much for your time and for your insights and your work over this whole series. I really hope that people have found it informative, that it will help them to do these things that we're talking about, to pray, to take action, to remember the people of North Korea. So thank you so much for joining us and taking us on this journey these past few episodes.
You're very welcome. I hope it's been helpful.
Thanks so much. We'll be back in January. So we're going to be taking a break now for the rest of December, and we will be back with a new series in January. So from all of us at CSW, wish you a Merry Christmas and a wonderful Advent season. And we pray that you're all very, very blessed, and we'll see you when we return in January. Thanks so much. Thank you for listening to the CSW Free to Believe podcast. CSW is a Christian human rights organization advocating for freedom of religion or belief. As Christians, we stand with everyone facing injustice because of their religion or belief. This work, including the podcast, exists because of the generosity of supporters just like you. If you'd like to find out more or to make a donation, go to csw.org.uk. You can also help by sharing our work with people you know, reviewing the podcast, and following us on social media. All the links you need are in the description box underneath this episode.